Cultural and structural racism in America has a profound impact on the lives of boys and men. Emily Badger, a writer for the New York Times Upshot, dove into data from researchers at American universities, Stanford, Harvard, and the Census Bureau that reveals that black boys raised in America, even in the wealthiest families and living in some of the most well-to-do neighborhoods, still earn less in adulthood than white boys with similar backgrounds. Emily Badger is here to discuss her article, Extensive Data Shows Punishing Reach of Racism for Black Boys, and she's joined by Ibram Kendi, a professor of history and international relations at American University. Welcome to you both.
Hi, Rebecca. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be on the show.
Emily, I'm going to start with you. I mean, there's so much in this piece and in this report that is striking and jarring, but one fact that really stood out, and I had to reread it several times, is that black men raised in the top 1% by millionaires were as likely to be incarcerated as white men raised in households earning about $36,000. Can you please talk to me about that?
Yeah, I mean, you're right. There are so many individual pieces of data in this study that are really sort of striking about the enormous inequality between black and white men, whether we're talking about incarceration, whether we're talking about sort of their adult outcomes and how much money they make. And all of them, that incarceration data in particular, really sort of point back to the central idea, which is that, you know, even when black and white boys grow up in very, very similar circumstances, you know, in families that earn the same amount of money, in, families that live in the same neighborhoods, that send their children to the same schools, black and white boys wind up growing up to be men who have very, very different outcomes. You know, the white boy almost all of the time is going to fare better in the economy, is going to earn more money. And, I think one of the first questions that we wondered when we were looking at this data was, you know, where does incarceration fit into this? I mean, the criminal justice system is sort of an inseparable part of the larger whole when we're thinking about, you know, how do black and white boys interact differently with the world when they walk outside of their homes? What's sort of shaping the very different life trajectories that they have? And, you know, so I think that one statistic that you mentioned is, this really sort of striking piece that's not necessarily sort of the top line finding here, but it's one of these little things that's sort of, you know, really essential to helping us understand what's going on here.
I think for a lot of people who read the piece were struck by the data and the numbers for sure, because there they are. There, you know, there's no sort of arguing those numbers. But I think it's also then important to bring it back into a context of actual culture and livelihood. Ibram, I want to ask you, how do you think certain stereotypes of black men factor into these economic disparities?
Well, I think those stereotypes or those racist ideas are critical. And so I think you had, of course, asked about mass incarceration and how richer black boys are more likely to be incarcerated than more working class white boys or men. And I think it's because our perception of the black male body in particular as criminal until proven otherwise. And so personally, you know, I actually was, I think in some ways part of that data set. I was born in 1982, and I can recall countless times, and I grew up in a middle income home, and I can recall countless times in which I've been suspected by the police as a criminal, in which I was followed in particular types of ways and suspected when my white male friends were not. And so I think, you know, this concept of black boys is dangerous and black neighborhoods is dangerous, I think is certainly a factor in this data.
And do you think also that those perceptions and those stereotypes are then internalized by black boys and men?
I think they are in certain types of ways. So I write about the ways in which black people have internalized racist ideas about black people. But even something as simple as, you know, every morning when I put on my hoodie and run and go to the gym, I'm conscious of the fact that people are seeing me as a threat when I cross the street and head by them. So I may not necessarily do certain things to make people feel safe. So there's many different ways in which it's internalized. And I think one of the ways it's internalized is because black boys and men know people perceive them as a threat. So we try to figure out ways to allow people to not view us as such. That's why some black men will never wear a hoodie, or some black men always dress up in suits whenever they leave the house.
Emily, the lead of the story is that black boys raised in America, even in the wealthiest families and living in some of the most well-to-do neighborhoods, still earn less in adulthood than white boys with similar backgrounds. How much less?
It's a substantial amount. I mean, what these researchers were looking at is they're sort of dividing up the income spectrum in America into percentiles and saying, you know, if you're born at the 60th percentile in America, if you're raised in a family that way, you know, how much money are you likely to make by the time you get older? Do children raised at the 60th percentile make themselves, you know, something equivalent to the 60th percentile? And it's this quite striking gap of about 13 percentiles between black boys and men, where effectively white men are making that much more than black men are. That's consistent from, whether they're born poor or whether they're born in really wealthy households. And, you know, we're talking over the course of a lifetime about, you know, tens of thousands of dollars that add up. I mean, this is sort of a snapshot of how much men are making at a given point when they're in their mid-30s, when they're mid-career and fairly well-established in the economy. But, you know, when you translate those numbers into sort of the cumulative effect year after year after year, I mean, this is how, you know, this problem of income inequality compounds and translates into an even bigger problem of wealth inequality.
Right. I was going to say that I think it's important to also look at the difference between wealth and income, right?
Yeah, that's exactly the case. I mean, there's a lot of different ways to think about economic inequality, and income is just one of them. And, you know, income means something significantly different from wealth, although the two are related. But what these researchers are looking here is specifically measures of income, because they're looking at effectively tax filings, IRS data, on some 20 million children who grew up in America. You know, Dr. Kendi, me, I'm in this data as well. Basically, everyone in America born between 1978 and 1983, who's now in their mid to late 30s, you know, how much are you claiming now when you file your taxes? So they have very, very good data on how much people are making in their income, but they have less good data on, how wealth fits into the picture. And obviously, wealth is an important part of this picture, too, because there's really substantial differences between the amounts of wealth that black and white families have access to, because that is something that accumulates across generations. You know, that's something that sort of is related to how much money your grandparents were making, your great-grandparents were making.
I'm speaking with Emily Badger from the New York Times and Ibram Kendi from American University. Ibram, you're quoted in the article, the New York Times article, is saying one of the most popular liberal post-racial ideas is the idea that the fundamental problem is class and not race, and clearly this study explodes that idea. Let's break that down. It's one of those ongoing arguments that we hear. It's about class, not race. So let's talk about it in very salient terms.
Sure. So I think to think about it very simply, typically liberals are willing to admit that there is some sort of racial problem, meaning they look out at the racial disparities and see a problem. And they typically see that problem is stemming from discrimination, while conservatives are less likely to admit that there's even a problem, and certainly less likely to admit that problem is stemming from discrimination. And then the question becomes, what type of discrimination? And so what became popular, particularly during the post-racial era, was this, among liberals, was this idea that the problem of discrimination was a problem of economic discrimination. And so that if we only sort of allow black people to rise in the economic ladder, then those disparities, those racial disparities, will wither away. While this study shows that problem is actually not a problem of class, but a problem of race. Or the problem is not a problem of economic discrimination, but it's probably a problem of racial discrimination.
Right. And so how do you, I mean, I understood what you said there, but just in terms of really kind of clarifying what has to do with class and what has to do with race in this context?
Well, I think first and foremost, to make it even more complex while clarifying simultaneously, if that's possible, I think we've had this longstanding debate, and this is even before recent decades, about whether the problem is race or class, and as opposed to us recognizing the intersection of race and class. And so, for instance, for a poor black family facing both racial and economic discrimination, or even a rich black family facing both economic and racial discrimination. And mm-hmm. so it's our job then as researchers to figure out, okay, what are those intersections? And then what are the ways they're facing economic? And then what is the way they're facing racial? Mm-hmm. But when you have a racial disparity, the cause of a racial disparity is racial discrimination. Just like when you have an economic disparity, the cause is economic discrimination. Gender disparity, the cause is some form of gender discrimination.
Emily, in the study, there's also an attempt to identify neighborhoods where poor black boys do well, and as well as whites, but there were few neighborhoods that met the standard, but parts of Maryland, suburbs of Washington, and corners of Queens and the Bronx. What were some of the characteristics of these neighborhoods that helped poor black boys succeed?
Yeah, it's one of the other really remarkable and depressing, in fact, points about this study was that the kind of neighborhoods that you're describing are so, so rare. I mean, basically, in 99% of America, the white boy is going to do better than the black boy is in the economy when they grow up, even if they start in very, very similar circumstances. So the researchers then ask, okay, that 1% where this is not true, what do we know about those places? Can we take the things that we learn about those places and use that to try to apply lessons and create policies for the rest of America? So there were a couple of common factors of these very few neighborhoods where black and white boys are both doing well and they're doing equally well. And, you know, one of them is that these are communities that tend to have low poverty rates. This is perhaps not surprising. These aren't places that, you know, are dealing with really endemic poverty. They tend to be located in regions where on some kinds of tests it appears as if whites discriminate against blacks less. This is probably not the most ironclad finding in the whole study, because whether or not people discriminate is a very, very difficult thing to measure. Mm-hmm. But to the extent that we have some data on it, it looks as if in places where there's less discrimination, black boys are doing better. And they're also doing better in communities where there are a lot of lower-income black children who have fathers at home. And this is this really sort of interesting and in some ways kind of perplexing finding of this study. Because what that's saying is not, you know, black boys do well when they have their own fathers at home. They're saying black boys do well when they live in communities where there are other fathers around. You know, they're describing something about the quality of a neighborhood, not about the quality of a household. And, you know, exactly what that gets at, the researchers can't say. We don't know if this is a story about, you know, black children growing up with black men around them who are mentors, who are role models, you know, who may be sort of functioning in their lives in some other way, or who may just be sort of indicative of other circumstances of the community. But, you know, that's one of the sort of intriguing pieces of this study that other researchers need to pick up and figure out a lot more about.
Ibram, what are your thoughts on that? I mean, that was really striking to me as well, that black fathers played such a role.
So, I mean, I think in Emily's article, that she pointed to both the factor of models and mentors, as well as communities that may have lower incarceration rates and better job opportunities. And I would probably lean towards the latter, that the presence of black fathers and black men in a community is going to clearly, or greater presence, I should say, than other communities is clearly a result of them not being as likely to be incarcerated and have better opportunities. So therefore, boys coming up in that environment are less likely to be incarcerated and are more likely to have opportunities. When they work hard, their hard work will be rewarded. So that's what it seems like to me, but I think it's something that I think we should be investigating as opposed to what's wrong with these black boys.
I'm Rebecca Carroll, and I'm speaking with Emily Badger, a writer for the New York Times Upshot, about her story, Extensive Data Shows Punishing Reach of Racism for Black Boys, along with Ibram Kendi, a professor of history and international relations at American University, who is featured in the article. This is Midday on WNYC, and I'm back with Emily Badger and Ibram Kendi. Before the break, Emily, we were talking about the impact of black men, fathers and mentors on black boys in neighborhoods. Was there any stipulation in the data of what these men were doing? Were they working? Were they, at the local Y? You know, what were the roles that they were in?
We don't know exactly what these men were doing. And, you know, there are a lot of questions that readers have brought to us about, you know, what's actually happening in these families? What are the differences between the people who are succeeding and who aren't succeeding? That get at issues that we simply can't answer, because all of this data that we're talking about comes from government sources like the Census Bureau and the IRS. So, you know, you're not telling the IRS whether or not you spend your free time volunteering at the Y. You know, you don't tell the Census Bureau whether or not you read 10 books to your children every week at home. So there's sort of a granularity to the experience of children's lives and the roles that people play in communities that that we can't quite get at here. You know, that's sort of the downside of having data about 20 million people. We sort of lose the level of detail I think we would really like to have in a different kind of study. But I would say that I agree with what Dr. Kendi was saying earlier. I suspect that what's happening here is not so much, you know, this role model and mentoring role, but that, you know, when lower income black men are present in the homes of their children, you know, that tells us something very, very particular about the kinds of communities that they're growing up in. You know, this tells us that there's economic opportunity in those places, as Dr. Kendi mentioned, you know, that there's less incarceration in those places. You know, I kind of think of lower income black fathers as being this very sort of particular canary in the coal mine that tells us about the health of the community. You know, when we're supporting those men and we're making it possible for them to be good partners and present fathers, you know, that means a lot of other really good stuff is happening in a community.
Ibram, the data found that black girls from the wealthiest families do not have the same earning wealth gap in adulthood, and yet they face not only racism but sexism as well. So what do you think the explanation between their different outcomes from black boys as adults is about?
I think that's something that I think a lot of people have asked, and I think that's something that we should further investigate. One thing I would say is I think it may be the case that the income levels are similar, but the wealth levels are profoundly different between white women and black women. And I think there are many different ways in which we can sort of think through the way wealth and income operate between the genders.
Mm-hmm.
And so to sort of explain that. But I think it's something that's quite interesting, because I think we certainly have been tracking. I know from my generation, you know, a lot of black women would lament that there weren't more black men on their college campuses, particularly if they went to HBCUs. And so clearly, you know, having more black women on college campuses is going to presumably lead to more economic sort of outlook for them. But then simultaneously, this sort of mass incarceration of black men has certainly harmed sort of the economic chances of those men. But we should also remember that, you know, black women and black men are simultaneously discriminated against in similar ways and different ways. And so I think this study in particular is looking at the ways in which black boys and black men are discriminated against, just like we should have other studies that I think specifically look at the way black women are discriminated against, you know, within the economic market.
And what are some of those differences in terms of discrimination?
Well, I think that clearly a lot of it has to do with how people are perceiving these different groups. And so, for instance, I mean, historically, black women were domestics who were being discriminated against in all different types of ways in the home, while black men were more likely to be farmers, and so they were being hyper-exploited by landowners. I think currently black boys and black men are more likely to be incarcerated. However, when black women and white women are holding similar positions, those black women are less likely to receive equal pay. They're also more likely to be perceived in the job space as sort of angry or as seeking to dominate. Particularly, white men view them in that way. I also know in the academy, in higher education, black women or women of color are more likely to not be tenured than any other racial gender group, which, of course, tenure is, you know, you have job security. And so I think there are many different sort of ways in which that's happening.
Emily, you spoke of the granularity of the data, and it is quite dense and extensive. And what do you do with this information you know, what is the thread? How do you keep it going? What, how do you, the, you know, the first thing I thought when I read this was, there's so much information here. We have evidence that we can build on. How do we build on this evidence and data to make structural changes?
Well, I think there's sort of two different questions. One is, if you are an individual, and if you're raising children, what do you do about this? And then the other question is, what do we as a society do? If we're going to start talking about policy solutions, what would those look like? And, you know, in answer to the first question, one of the things that this study suggests is that, you know, the neighborhood where you choose to raise your children, if you have the luxury of choosing where you raise your children, is really important. You know, you particularly if you are an African American parent, you know, this data suggests that you may want to try to find a community where your child is going to experience less discrimination, where it appears as if there's sort of equal opportunity for black and white children, that you want to be really sort of intentional in that way about choosing the community where you live. But this also suggests sort of from a policy point of view, on the one hand, that we need to try to create more of those kinds of communities across the country. But to come back to, you know, one of the original ideas that we were discussing, that this suggests that there is a problem of race, not just a problem of class in America, that translates very directly to the sorts of policy solutions that we should be talking about. I mean, if you think that racial inequality in America is fundamentally a problem about class, what that says from a policy point of view in Washington is we could tailor programs that would benefit poor people, and those would benefit African Americans as well, and over time that would solve racial inequality. And this basically says, no, that's not going to cut it. You can't just tailor programs to benefit lower-income people and hope that it solves our racial problems as well. You know, we also need to be thinking sort of very intentionally, specifically about how do we create opportunity for these groups that have been very specifically disadvantaged. You know, we're talking in particular about black boys, but this is true of black boys and black girls as well. You know, how are we being conscious of the opportunities that their families are given and where they get to choose where to live? You know, how are we being conscious of how, you know, teachers are offering opportunity to some, more likely to discipline some children rather than others? You know, there are all of these little ways in which these inequalities are sort of baked into society, and the policy response to this says we need to pay a lot of attention to what those racial differences are, instead of just saying, you know, let's build programs to lift poor people out of poverty, and that's going to solve this problem also.
I'm speaking with Emily Badger, a writer for the New York Times, and Ibram Kendi, a professor at American University. Emily spoke earlier, or just now, about making choices, African-American parents making choices to live in neighborhoods where there seems to be more racial equality. Broadly speaking, where are those communities?
As we said earlier, they are very rare, and it's hard to find them. We know that there are some in the Washington, D.C. suburbs. So I went to downtown Silver Spring in the course of reporting on this project because this was a place that appeared to have these qualities. Prince George's County, which is another area in the suburbs of Washington that has historically had a really strong black middle class. There are some areas of the New York suburbs and in the Bronx as well. That's not an exhaustive list, though. And these researchers have not yet released at the neighborhood level exactly where we can find all of these places. I suspect that they'll be doing that in the future. But just to describe a little bit more what downtown Silver Spring is like, because that's a place where I thought a lot about what are we talking about here. You know, this is a community that has a lot of income diversity. Income diversity is made possible there because, you know, there are both these sort of really expensive mansions where wealthy people live, but then there are also these big apartment buildings where it has historically been possible for lower and more moderate income people to live. It's a community that has a lot of immigrants there, a lot of immigrant-owned businesses. You know, diversity there means a lot of different things. It means income diversity, it means racial diversity, it means diversity that includes, you know, immigrants who have come from Ethiopia and who've come from the Caribbean. And, you know, that's a place, too, where a lot of sort of intentional policy thinking has gone into, you know, trying to create income-diverse communities, trying to create sort of more sustainable opportunity across a pretty strong school system. So those are sort of some of the things that I think are important that researchers will have to learn more about, but I suspect they will find as important as well.
Ibram, I was so struck by some of the responses on Twitter to this piece, namely from sort of well-established black male thought leaders and high-profile folks. And I wondered if it's possible, if you are able to take your researcher hat off and read this piece and this data just as a black man and what that feels like.
Well, I think as a black man, it sort of confirms many things that I suspected growing up over the last 35 years in this country, in which I saw other groups, particularly white boys who had similar educational levels, came from similar backgrounds, you know, advancing ahead of me and ahead of my friends. And, you know, of course, we were suspecting some form of racial discrimination, but, you know, our consciousness or awareness couldn't necessarily pinpoint it. And so I think it's very difficult to know that you simply working hard, you simply doing all of the things that America says you're supposed to do in order to be successful, and you do those things and you're still not successful, and then you get blamed for it. And I think that's the difficulty that black men face, just like black women and other groups that face discrimination, to do the things they're supposed to do. And then when you don't succeed because of discrimination, you're blamed. And then some people internalize that and say, yeah, I am to blame, which only makes it harder for them to succeed. And so I think it's very difficult. You know, it's very sort of, I read this piece both as a researcher and a black male, so it was very sort of jarring going back and forth emotionally and intellectually as I read.
Yeah, I imagine. Do you think that this data, this is to both of you, can be used as a tool moving forward in the conversation? I just keep returning to this idea of the evidence of it. And Ibram, you just said, you know, it was very jarring to go back and forth to read it, and but also it had reaffirmed so much of what you thought. But that doesn't change anything, the reaffirmation. So how do we make it change things?
Well, you know, one thing sorry, go ahead.
No, please, Emily.
What I was going to say is that, you know, I looked at this data and I thought, this pattern is so striking. How could you possibly deny that there is some kind of structural barrier that is preventing black boys from succeeding when we're looking at black and white boys who grow up in, you know, in identical circumstances, and they're not faring the same? And I thought, as I often think when I'm looking at research and writing about it, you know, this is the thing that's finally going to change some people's minds. You can't possibly look at these patterns and deny that this is a problem that we have in America. But you know, but then we start to get feedback to the story, and I realize this is a lesson that I relearn over and over again, that you know, data that I think is very powerful does not change many people's minds. You know, we heard from a lot of readers who saw this story, who looked at the same data that I looked at, that Dr. Kennedy looked at, who said, you know, well, isn't this evidence of there being, you know, cultural differences between black and white boys? Maybe it's black culture that's causing this. You know, they looked at that chart that we published about incarceration that you mentioned at the very beginning, that shows, you know, this remarkable fact that wealthy black boys are much more likely to be incarcerated than, you know, working class white boys. And they looked at that and they said, you know, well, that's just evidence of sort of the inherent criminality of black men. And you know, that was very sort of eye-opening for me to realize that, you know, presenting evidence like this doesn't change the conversation overnight. It's not even going to change many people's minds, because, you know, people's beliefs about racial inequality and whether or not it even exists are so deeply held, and they're so personally felt, you know, because I think a lot of white people don't want to sort of acknowledge that, you know, I got where I got because I've been given advantages. You know, other people are where they are because they face disadvantages. And, you know, that's a really sort of difficult thing to deal with. I absolutely think that this study is going to, you know, sort of move us forward, to change the conversation in some ways, but it's not going to be, you know, this sort of panacea that's going to wake everybody up to racial inequality and the fact that we need to do something about it in America.
Who has to care about this evidence and this data for things to change, Ibram?
Well, I think there have been many well-meaning Americans, black and white, who and other racial groups who really did deeply believe that the problem was class, either coming from a philosophical perspective or other perspectives. And I think for those people, and again, if these people are well-meaning and they're intellectuals, meaning they stare evidence in the face and change ideas as a result of it, then I think those people can and should be changing, and this study should mean a lot to them, so that when we begin to have these policy conversations again, they won't return to class. And then I think you also have politicians who like the class argument because they know precisely, as Emily stated, how pervasive racist ideas are in this country and how the class argument is less, as they would consider, divisive than recognizing that we need both class and racial sort of policies. And so then they fall back onto class. And so hopefully this study will give them the courage to stare the truth in the face and make policies as a result of that truth.
Emily, what would you add to that in terms of your hope for the kind of impact on the reader this piece has?
You know, I talked to a couple of people who told me that looking at this data changed how they think about things, and I found that to be really powerful. I mean, one of the ways in which that was true was that, you know, one researcher said to me, if you had asked me what was the single most important thing we could do to solve this problem, I would have said desegregation. You know, make it possible for black and white families to live in the same communities, wherever they want to have access to the same amount of opportunity. And one of the things that this study says is that even when they do live in the same communities, and they live in the same, you know, kind of wealthy, liberal communities, suburban communities that sort of think of themselves as being progressive in many ways, those places still have bad outcomes. And so I think that's sort of helpful, too, for saying, you know, there are some limitations, too, to a lot of policy solutions people have proposed to this. I'm certainly not saying that we shouldn't pursue desegregation, but this suggests that, you know, simply encouraging black parents to get married is not going to solve the problem. You know, sort of simply picking up poor black children and dropping them in, you know, wealthy white suburbs is not going to solve the problem. You know, simply making sure that everyone gets an education is not going to solve the problem, because we see these disparities existing between people with similar kinds of education. So it's also sort of helpful, I think, in pointing to the limitations of some solutions that people have proposed in the past.
I'm Rebecca Carroll, and I've been speaking with Emily Badger, a writer for the New York Times, Upshot, about her story, Extensive Data Shows Punishing Reach of Racism for Black Boys, along with Ibram Kendi, a professor of history and international relations at American University. Thank you both so much for joining me today. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having the conversation.
Yeah, thank you so much, Rebecca and Emily.